Well, we've all spent time in school. Some days, I think, forcing ourselves to stay awake through classes where what we were taught was tedious. It was seemingly irrelevant information about the past. Now, our history courses were usually presented, at least mine were, is dry series of names of mostly dead people, of the dates, of obscure events that we couldn't identify with, and a list of place names that we forgot minutes after we were told them. So it is our knee-jerk reaction, I think, to study the ancient history of Israel as contained in the Bible with those same expectations. Now, as I told you the last time, in our introduction to the Book of Kings, the Book of Kings indeed takes us through an enormous amount of Israel's history, a 450-year period from the time that David handed the throne over to Solomon until Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and took Judah captive up to Babylon. And as tempting as it will be to see and to hear what we study in this book in the same way that the post-Enlightenment era Bible scholars often do, that is, it's just mere secular history that's told with superstitious religious overtones, we need to avoid that. Rather, we are studying the path of our own redemption history. It's told in the Book of Kings as essentially the fulfillment of Nathan's prophetic oracle to King David. This oracle stated that David's would be an everlasting dynasty, and that even though many of the kings it would produce would be wicked, and they would be punished severely for their disobedience to God, nonetheless, God would not abandon David's royal descendants as he did King Saul. The church that has done such a marvelous job of extending the truth of God's grace through Messiah to our entire globe has also tended to disregard this foundational part of our redemption history with an ambivalent attitude, and I hope we can remedy some of that. The first 11 chapters of the book of 1 Kings are all about King Solomon and his 40-year reign over a united, a prosperous, and influential kingdom of Israel. So let's read this first chapter that tells us the story of King Solomon's coronation. Open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 1. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, the page is 366. It's a long chapter. We're going to read it all. King David grew old, and the years took their toll, and he couldn't get warm even when they covered him with bedclothes. His servant said to him, "Let us try to find a young virgin for my lord the king. She can wait on the king and be a companion for him, and she can lie next to you so that my lord the king will get some heat." And looking through all of Israel's territory for a beautiful girl, they found Avishag the Shunammite and brought her to the king. And the girl was very beautiful and became a companion for the king. She took care of him, but the king didn't have sexual relations with her. Adoniah, the son of Haggith, was beginning to claim that he would be king. To this end, he organized chariots and horsemen with 50 men to run ahead of him. His father had never in his life confronted him by asking, "Why are you behaving this way?" Moreover, he was a very handsome man. He was born next ever after Absalom. Well, he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and Abiathar the Kohen, the priest, and they both supported Adoniah. But Zadok the priest and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rei, and David's elite guard were not on Adoniah's side. And one day Adoniah killed sheep and oxen and fattened calves at the stone of Zochlet by Engrogel. And he summoned all of his brothers, the king's sons, and all of the men of Judah, the king's servants, but he did not summon Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, the elite guard, or Shlomo, Solomon, his brother. Natan went to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and said, "Haven't you heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggit, has become king without the knowledge of David, our Lord? Now come, please, let me have your advice so that you can save both your own life and that of your son Shlomo. Go, get in to see King David and say to him, 'My lord king, didn't you swear to your servants your son Shlomo will be king after me? He'll sit on my throne. So why is Adonijah king?' Right then, while you are still talking with the king, also come in after you and confirm what you're saying." Well, Bathsheba went into the king in his room. The king was very old. Abishag the Shunammite was in attendance on the king. And Bathsheba bowed, prostrating herself to the king. And the king asked, "What do you want?" And she answered him, "My lord, you swore by Adonai your God to your servant, your son Shlomo will be king after me. He'll sit on my throne. But now here's Adonijah ruling as king. And you, my lord the king, don't know anything about it. He's killed oxen, fattened calves, and sheep in great numbers. He's summoned all the sons of the king, Abiathar the Kohen, Joab the commander of the army, but he didn't summon Solomon your servant. Now as for you, my lord the king, all Israel is watching you. They're waiting for you to tell them who's going to sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Now if you don't, then when the lord my king sleeps with his ancestors, I and my son Shlomo will be considered criminals." Right then, while she was still talking with the king, Nathan the prophet entered, and they told the king, "Nathan the prophet is here." And after coming into the king's presence, he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And Nathan said, "My lord king, did you say Adonijah is to be king after me? He'll sit on my throne? For he's gone down today and killed oxen and fattened calves and sheep in great numbers. He summoned all the king's sons, the commanders of the army, Abiathar the Kohen. Right now they're eating and drinking in his presence and proclaiming, 'Long live King Adonijah!' But he didn't summon me, your servant, or Sadok the Kohen, or Benaiah the son of Yehoda, or your servant Shlomo. Is this authorized by my lord, the king? Without your having told your servant who would sit on the throne of my lord the king after him?" King David answered by saying, "Summon Bathsheba to me." She entered the king's presence and stood before the king, and then the king swore an oath, "As Adonai lives, who has delivered me from all adversity, as I swore to you by Adonai, the God of Israel, your son, Shlomo, Solomon, will be king after me. He'll sit on my throne in my place, so I will do today." Bathsheba bowed with her face to the ground, prostrating herself to the king, and said, "Let my lord King David live forever." King David said, "Summon Sadok the Kohen, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada." And they came before the king, and the king said to them, "Take with you the servants of your lord. Have Shlomo my son ride on my own mule and bring him down to Gihon. There Sadok the Kohen and Nathan the prophet are to anoint him king over Israel. Sound the shofar and say, 'Long live King Shlomo!' Then escort him back. He is to come and sit on my throne, for he is to take my place as king. I have appointed him to rule over Israel and Judah." Benaiah responded to the king by saying, "Amen. May Adonai, the God of my lord the king, confirm it. Just as Adonai has been with my lord the king, so may he be with Shlomo and make his throne even greater than the throne of my lord King David." So Sadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Kariti and the Peliti went down, had Shlomo ride on King David's mule, and brought him to Gihon. Sadok the Kohen took the horn of olive oil out of the tent, and he anointed Solomon. They sounded the shofar, and all the people shouted, "Long live King Solomon!" And all the people escorted him back, playing flutes and rejoicing greatly, so that the earth shook with the sound. Adonijah and all his guests heard it while they were finishing their meal. But it was Joab who, when he heard the blast on the shofar, asked, "That noise, what's the meaning of this uproar in the city?" And while he was still speaking, there came Jonathan, the son of Abiathar the priest. And Adoniah said, "Come in, you're a worthy man. You must be bringing good news." Jonathan answered Adoniah, "The truth is, our Lord King David has made Shlomo king. Moreover, the king sent him with Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Kariti and the Peliti, and they had him ride on the king's mule. And Zadok the Kohen and Nathan the prophet anointed him king in Gihon. They escorted him back from their rejoicing so that the city's in an uproar." That's the noise you've been hearing. "Moreover, Shlomo is now sitting on the throne of the kingdom. More than that, the king's servants came and blessed our Lord King David with these words, 'May God make the name of Shlomo better than your name, his throne greater than your throne,' after which the king bowed down on the bed. Finally, the king said, 'Blessed be Adonai, the God of Israel, who has given someone to sit on my throne today, when my own eyes can see it.'" At this, Adonijah's guests grew frightened. They got up, everyone going his own way. Adoniah, too, was afraid because of Shlomo. He got up and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Shlomo was told, "Here, Adoniah is terrified of King Shlomo. He's grabbed hold of the horns of the altar and is saying, 'First let King Shlomo swear to me that he'll not have his servant executed.'" Shlomo said, "If he'll demonstrate that he's a worthy man, not a hair of his will fall to the earth. But if he's found making trouble, he'll die." So King Shlomo sent, and they brought him down from the altar. He came and prostrated himself before King Shlomo, and Shlomo said to him, "Go on home." There are two things that need to be said as a critical backdrop for understanding this chapter. First is that Adoniah holding himself up as king did not rise to the level of outright rebellion. Rather, it resulted from a misguided assumption on his part. And second is that without this incident of Adoniah unexpectedly holding a feast in honor of his anticipation of becoming king of Israel, David would not have been prodded to belatedly, after a lot of foot dragging, finally announce a successor, Solomon. Another helpful point of reference is that unlike most other situations in the Bible, whereby we move from one chapter on to the next, or we're dealing with a Bible book that originally was one large work, but now is divided up into multiple books, we cannot just turn the page from 2 Samuel chapter 24, which is the last chapter of 2 Samuel, to pages of 1 Kings 1, and then see them as connected in time. That is, what we read in the opening verses of 1 Kings chapter 1 is not a logical continuation with the final words of 2 Samuel chapter 24, the book before 1 Kings. And this is because the last four chapters of 2 Samuel are a later addition to the book that acts as a kind of an appendix to give us information about David's reign that was seen as important for context. Instead, then, sequentially speaking, 1 Kings chapter 1 comes right after the end of 2 Samuel chapter 20. That was the story of a second rebellion against David after the one led by his own son, Absalom. And this one was by a fellow named Sheva, who was from the northern tribes of Israel. And the story ended with a brief summation of the members of David's inner circle at the time that this rebellion was put down. And we read that in 2 Samuel chapter 20, where it says, "Once again, Joab was commander over the whole army of Israel, while Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kariti and the Peliti. Adoram was in charge of the forced labor. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the secretary of state. Sheba was recorder, Zadok and Abiathar were the priests, and Irah the Yairi was David's Kohen, is David's personal priest. And now the first words of First Kings chapter 1 continue that thought with, now King David grew old, the years took their toll, and he couldn't get warm even when they covered him with bedclothes. That's the flow of it. So essentially it jumps from 2 Samuel chapter 20 to 1 Kings chapter 1. So what we find next then is that David is prematurely old. Whereas just before Moses died, he was described as being of relatively good health, still with excellent eyesight at the ripe old age of 120 years. Just before David's death, he is described as old and frail and in ill health at the age of only 70. Let's recall that it might be perhaps 450 years between Moses and David. So there hasn't been some rapid decline in life expectancy since the time of the Exodus from Egypt to David's day that would account in a general way for his condition. Rather, the rabbis say that it was caused from a lifetime of stress, of battle, living in extreme conditions in the desert wilderness, exposure, fatigue. I would add to that list the consequences of the last several years of David's life as he went his own way. He lived like someone who wasn't redeemed, and he carried terrible guilt because of it. This lifestyle took away his shalom, his peace, his well-being, and so also took away his God-given vitality. While I wouldn't want to carry the analogy too far, it's not unlike men who have spent the bulk of their lives on drugs or as alcoholics, maybe in and out of prison. Their eyes on their faces look sunken and hollow. They're kind of bent over, heavily wrinkled. There is the walking dead at far too early a stage of life. The soul sickness of horrendous sin and guilt will do this to a man and to a woman. Even somebody who's been redeemed. After all, it's our spirits that have been saved for eternity, not these bodies. We all know of friends, of prominent men and women in ministry who've walked this sad road. And this is often the result of disobedience, especially later in life, when sometimes we let our guards down. This issue about David's inability to get warm when one is older is hardly unique for David. It is somewhat common in seniors and in the elderly, and there are a variety of medical conditions that can cause it. Thus, the solution was seen as finding a young woman to lie next to him to provide him with the needed body heat. Most Bibles start out in the first verse by saying, as in our complete Jewish Bible, that the years took their toll, or David was stricken in years, advanced in years. And while those are reasonable depictions of this situation, these words all miss an important nuance. The Hebrew words there are bo yomim. Literally, he came with days. This is an idiom, but it is a positive expression that explains in a positive way that a person has lived for a long time. Even more, it implies having lived a meaningful life. The reality is that one can live for many years but have have few days of worthwhile accomplishments in all that time. That is by no means news to us. We have several modern parables that express this kind of thought, such as, at our death, no one's going to write on our tombstone, "I wish I would have spent more time at the office." We've all heard or perhaps known wealthy people who look back over their lives and realize that their daily focus of accumulation of riches and power had brought them precious little peace, and that at the end, they'd stored up nothing but things that will ultimately have no lasting value. A great person looks back on a life full of fruitful days. A wicked person's life consists mostly of wasted days, of abused days. But that person is always usually full of excuses. Time is the currency of life that God gives to every human in varying amounts. I want you to think about that. Time is the currency of life. It's given to us by God, but we don't all receive the same. So the issue isn't how much time do we get? It's how we spend it. This is expressed in a wonderful way in the New Testament. I'm going to read to you a familiar parable of Yeshua. But I'm going to take the liberty to substitute the currency of time for the currency of talents that this parable uses. So if you want to follow along, fine, but you don't have to. This is going to be coming from Matthew chapter 25. I'm going to read from verses 14 through 30. And once again, I'm going to substitute the idea of time for money. Okay? And listen to what this sounds like. "For it'll be like a man about to leave home for a while who entrusted his possessions to his servants. To one he gave 5 years, to another 2 years, to another 1 year, each according to his ability, and then he left. And the one who had received 5 years immediately went out and invested it, and he earned another 5. Similarly, the one given 2 years earned another 2. But the one given 1 year, went off, and he dug a hole in the ground, and he hid his master's time. But after a long time, the master of those servants returned to settle accounts with them. The one who had received 5 years came forward bringing another 5 and said, 'Sir, you gave me 5 years. Here, I've made 5 more.' And his master said to him, 'Excellent. You are a good and worthy servant. You have been faithful with a small amount, so I'm going to put you in charge of a large amount. Come, join in your master's happiness.' Also, the one who had received 2 years came forward and said, 'Sir, you gave me 2 years. Here, I've made 2 more.' And his master said, 'Excellent. You are such a good and trustworthy servant. You have been faithful with a small amount, so I'm going to put you in charge of a large amount. Come, join in your master's happiness.' Now the one who had received 1 year, he came forward and said, 'Ah, I knew you were a hard man. You harvest where you don't plant, you gather where you don't sow seed. I was afraid, so I went and hid your year into the ground. Now here, just take what belongs to you.' 'You wicked, lazy servant,' said his master. 'So you knew, did you, that I harvest where I haven't planted and I gather where I didn't sow seed? Then you should have deposited that time with the bankers so that when I returned, I would at least have gotten back interest with my capital. take the years from him and give them to somebody who has 10. For everyone who has something will be given more, so that he will have more than enough. But from anyone who has nothing, even what he does have will be taken back from him. As for this worthless servant, throw him out in the dark where people will wail and grind their teeth. How we spend that currency of time is going to have a lot to do with what type of welcome we receive in heaven, but also what our earthly legacy will be, and whether ours is a life of true joy or merely a misspent life of regret from having sought hollow personal pleasures. A great person incorporates all of his life experiences with God into his very being, and they leave their indelible mark on him. He learns from them. He passes them on. Others let the events of their lives just slide by, forgotten, without any purpose. The words bo yomim, those words tell us that on balance, David's was a purposeful life. It was a meaningful life that would have a positive, lasting effect. Now in verse 2, we're told that David's servants decided that the solution to getting David some comfort by being able to feel warm was to provide him with a young virgin girl. And that the person they decided upon was this beautiful young lady named Avishag. And this decision to bring this girl to David wasn't sexual or erotic in purpose. It actually concerned a rather standard medical practice from that era, and it's confirmed in the writings of Josephus. Briefly, the idea basically follows one that's taught to this very day as an emergency treatment for hypothermia. And it is that a person who has been overly exposed to cold and their core body temperature is dangerously low, and especially if there isn't nearby medical help, needs to snuggle closely with somebody else to absorb that body heat that that other person is generating. Merely putting blankets on doesn't help very much, because blankets don't generate heat, they're just an insulator. But by borrowing on the metabolism of another person, heat's generated, and it can be readily absorbed by another person. What is being described is that poor old David is bedridden. Thus, of course, the girl will be lying down with him. However, it was also thought in that day that vitality and energy could be transferred from a healthy person to another person who's in need of that. So the hope was that the sedentary and infirm David would gain energy from a youthful and a vibrant younger person by means of close contact. Now, we can scoff at all this if we choose. But this idea of our bodies operating on energy that can be transmitted and transferred, well, that's central to modern Oriental medicine, and it's spreading to holistic medicine as well. Why is it stressed that this is a beautiful woman? Well, first of all, beauty was seen as more than skin deep. Outward beauty was associated with grace and usually seen as a physical manifestation of one's inward condition. Second, it was customary that royalty always received the best. Therefore, the king was surrounded with the best furniture, the best clothing, the best housing. He got the best chariot, the best food, and the best women. And since beautiful was typically seen as the definition of best when it came to women, and often in cases of men, which we'll soon see, it's natural that the woman brought to attend to David was very lovely to the eye. But she was no prostitute. She was to be a very dedicated caretaker to King David. And when verse 4 explains that David didn't have sex with her, it's not really about making sure that we don't get the wrong idea about the relationship. See, it means that this girl was not a new addition to King David's harem. This is an important thing. So his son Solomon would have no right to inherit her when his father passed away. Whether concubine or wife, the act of consummation had to occur in order for a woman to take on the legal status of a wife or a concubine. That we are explicitly told that Abishag did not have sex with David meant she was neither his wife nor his concubine. She was a servant, nothing more. I note this now because it's going to play a role in a future chapter. Well, now we meet Adoniah, son of Haggith. He was the fourth son born to King David. Adoniah means my Lord is Yah, my Lord is God, or my Lord is Yehovah. Yah is a shortened name for God. By birth order, he was the fourth in line for the throne. However, the three that had been in front of him were dead. Amnon, the firstborn, was killed by his half-brother Absalom. Absalom was killed by David's nephew Joab, and Chileav seems to have died very young, as we're told of his birth, but never again do we hear his name. Therefore, by all custom and tradition, Adoniah is just a heartbeat away from the throne of Israel. Thus, he did mimic what his deceased brother Absalom had done. He rode all around Jerusalem in a royal chariot with 50 bodyguards running ahead of him to clear traffic. This display of pomp and ceremony was supposed to let everybody know that he was the crown prince and would soon be king. Verse 8 gives us an explanation of why Adoniah would behave as disrespectfully as he did towards his father. It was that David was an overly indulgent father who never disciplined his sons. This was another negative trait of David, and it served to result in his sons feeling entitled and arrogant. Now it would come back to haunt David, just as it did with all of his other sons. We're also told that Adoniah was a very handsome man, beautiful's actually the word, as was Absalom. This is meant from the same sense as it was referred to David's female servant, Abishag. And again, the idea is that outward physical beauty was thought to be reflective of very good inner qualities. And of course, when it comes to royalty, humans want our leaders to be first and foremost very attractive and personable. In verse 5, Adoniah is recorded as saying, Ani Amalech, I will be king. And this is important to understand, because the idea is that he is announcing an expectation. He is not proclaiming that I am now king. And this is coming from his assumption that his next in line by birth, when his father David dies, well, he'll assume the throne. But then we find out that there is a serious split within David's inner circle in regards to who each faction backed to be the next king. Joab, David's top military commander, and Abiathar, one of the two current high priests, were for Adoniah. However, the other high priest, Zadok, and then David's chief of the bodyguards, Benaiah, as well as all the bodyguards themselves, and the prophet Nathan, and two unknown folks named Shimei and Rei all supported Solomon to be king. Verse 9 explains that one day, Adoniah threw a major banquet by a place called Ein Rogel and invited all of his brothers and all of David's servants who were of the tribe of Judah. In other words, King David's own tribe. In other words, this was a large family gathering. However, he didn't invite Nathan, Benaiah, any of David's bodyguard forces, or his brother, Solomon. What this tells us is that he was fully aware that there was an expectation from many that he would be bypassed and that Solomon, his brother, would become the king. So this banquet and this riding around on a royal chariot was essentially a political rally to gather support. We've seen those. But those who came to it were taking a great risk. I mean, this could have turned into a life and death matter. Because if David chose Solomon and not Adonijah, it was nearly certain that Solomon would have those who were currently opposed to him, and they were for his brother, executed. Well, now let's take just a brief moment to identify the players. Evyatar was one of two high priests, and he was descended from the priests whom King Saul had slaughtered at Nob. Evyatar's father was a survivor that David rescued and took in. However, for reasons that aren't recorded, David has added Zadok as yet another high priest. Now, obviously, both can't be legitimate high priests. And sure enough, Evyatar is not of the proper high priest lineage. Rather, he is from the line of Ithamar. Ithamar is an Aaronic, or rather a Levitic line coming down from Aaron, but it's the wrong line. He was also descended from Eli, Samuel's mentor, but neither was Eli of the God-authorized line of high priests. Joab was David's nephew and his top general, but David had no use for him. Joab was a ruthless manipulator who looked out mainly for himself. David had never forgiven him for killing his son Absalom after David had given Joab strict orders to go gently with Absalom. You remember that? Now, on the other side of the ledger was Zadok, the other high priest. Zadok was the legitimate high priest because he was of the God-authorized line of Eleazar. Now, whether or not David had brought him on board for that reason is uncertain. David didn't seem to have had, at least in recent years, very much concern for the Torah law. Now, Nathan, of course, was the legitimate prophet of God that was David's access, if you would, to the Lord's oracle. Under what circumstances he was assigned, we don't know. He just kind of appears on the scene. And he's the one who chastises David over the Bathsheba affair, if you'll recall. And then he pronounces God's curse upon David for it. But key to our story is that he's also the one who pronounced God's oracle that David's dynasty would be forever. And that apparently Solomon was God's choice to succeed David. Now, Benaiah, he was a longtime loyal leader of David's palace guard and had been with him for decades. Naturally, he would side with whom he perceived as David's choice of successor. Well, the place of this banquet was just outside of the fortress walls that protected the city of David. It was located about 300 meters or so down the hill at the southern corner of the city. It was kind of a public place. And just as importantly, it meant that Adonijah in no way did this in secret. He wasn't having a secret meeting, a secret banquet. He did it right under the nose of his father. Nathan hears of it. He runs to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, and asks if she's aware of this turn of events. But Nathan, in some ways, misinterprets what he sees. He believes that Adonijah has pronounced himself king as of now. And why wouldn't he think so? This banquet's being held at a water source so that he can be immersed. And the high priest Evyatar is there to anoint him with holy oil, which is the primary way in which Israelite kings were coronated. Even though that's not what's happening, Nathan assumes it is. Or at least he fears that it is, and he's not taking any chances. Why is Nathan in the middle of this ruckus? In fact, he's the driving force to thwart Adonijah and is the head of the opposition party, so to speak. It comes from this fact. Long ago, God ordained that what men consider as the customary line of succession to become king is subservient to Jehovah's choice as to who will be king. The Lord has never been a respecter of persons. And since Genesis, we have watched as God shunned the physically firstborn and instead chose another to use for his purposes, even in moving his line of promise forward. Isaac was chosen instead of his older brother, Ishmael. Jacob instead of Esau. Judah instead of Reuben. On and on it goes. And here, even though by all human traditions and genealogies, Adonijah ought to become the next king of Israel, the Lord has chosen Solomon. And the way the Lord communicates that choice is through his prophet, Nathan. This is not an abstract principle of the Lord being the heavenly king who selects the earthly king by whatever criteria he so deems. This is actually a Torah law, a God principle that's found in the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 17, we read this. When you have entered the land Adonai your God is giving you, and you have taken possession of it, and you're living there, you may say, I want to have a king over me like all the other nations around me. In that event, you must appoint as king the one whom Adonai your God will choose. He must be one of your kinsmen, this king you appoint over you, and you are forbidden to appoint a foreigner over you who's not your kinsman. The one whom Adonai, your God, will choose. And only in the most general sense are we ever given the reasons why the Lord selects and elects as he does. He is sovereign. We don't need to know why. Here, it is less a matter of God's criteria. It's more a matter of whom it is who announces the new king. In reality, David had several sons, and he had a number of legitimate choices to succeed him, with Adonijah as the most logical by reason of birth order. But as Jehovah's earthly representative, Nathan's announcement of Shlomo as the king is merely the announcement to the Israelites of God's choice. He made that choice a long time ago. So we need to see that the kingly succession by birth order, that's just a human concept. That's not a God concept. Now, frankly, I still think that Solomon was the least likely of all to be king. He was the youngest of David's living sons, so far as we know. The rabbis say he was only 12 years old at this time, but more likely he's in his late teens. And he's the byproduct of a pretty scandalous affair. I mean, I don't need to remind you that his mother is the infamous Bathsheba, whose illegitimate son she had with David died as an infant, and that Solomon was the next child to be born to Bathsheba. And even though Bathsheba and David were married when Solomon was conceived, neither Bathsheba nor Solomon would have been very welcome in the harem. They wouldn't have been respected by the Israelite community at large. The whole seedy thing was tainted with adultery and murder and favoritism. So Nathan uses the power of his personality and of his office to manipulate Bathsheba to go to her husband, the king, to inform him of the news that, according to Nathan, Adonijah has declared himself as king. And again, this isn't really true. Didn't happen. So Nathan carefully orchestrates now the situation. He puts words in her mouth. He tells Bathsheba to say precisely what to say, how to say it. And then after she speaks, he will just coincidentally drop by the palace. Just the right moment. and he'll confirm her words and explain to David that he must do something immediately or Solomon's going to lose the throne. Now, I want you to notice that what happens from verse 5, which is this elaborate dinner banquet, to the end of the chapter, with Solomon as king and sparing Adonijah's life for now anyway, this all occurs in a matter of hours. It's that urgent. In verse 13, Nathan has Bathsheba remind the feeble David, "My lord king, didn't you swear to your servant, your son Solomon will be king after me? He'll sit on my throne. So why is Adonijah king?" A good question for any Bible student to ask about now. When did we ever hear of this promise before? That Solomon was to be king. In reality, nowhere in earlier scriptures is this ever plainly stated. The one sort of even fuzzy allusion to this occurs in 2 Samuel chapter 12. There it says, David comforted his wife, Bathsheba, came to her and went to bed with her, and she gave birth to a son and named him Shlomo, and Adonai loved him, and sent through Nathan the prophet to have him named Yedidiah, loved by God, for Adonai's sake. So the idea that God gave Solomon a specially divinely ordained name, Yedidiah, loved by God, is about the only clue we've been given before this chapter in 1 Kings that Solomon was to be David's successor. That's a pretty fuzzy one. We do get a bit more information about this later on in 1 Chronicles 22, where it says, "My son," said David to Shlomo, "my heart was set on building a house for the name of Adonai my God, but a message from Adonai came to me. You have shed much blood and fought great wars. So you are not to build a house for my name, because you have shed so much blood on the earth in my sight. But you will have a son who will be a man of rest. I'll give him rest from all of his enemies that surround him. His name is to be Shlomo. And during his reign, I will give peace and quiet to Israel. It is he who will build a house for my name. He will be my son. I will be his father. I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever." So we are to understand that the source of the message from Adonai, from God, that Solomon would reign, had to have been Nathan the prophet, because he was God's official messenger to David at this time. I think we'll close here for this evening, and we'll continue next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.